The next matter on the calendar is the case of Kristen Sharonzi versus Vericon, Inc. and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Counsel for relator, you may proceed when ready, and will both attorneys, when you reach the podium, please identify yourselves for us.
Thank you, Your Honor. Benjamin Weiss of Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, representing relator Kristen Sharonzi. The question in this case is, does an order from this court mean what it says? Ms. Sharonzi was discharged solely for accumulating too many points under a no-fault attendance policy. The employer didn't make any claim that she was discharged because of the reason for her final absence, but the unemployment law judge determined that the reason for the final absence established employment misconduct. That question came up to appeal before this court, and this court determined that the ULJ had applied the wrong analysis. In paragraph 6 of the remand order, this court wrote, the ULJ focused too closely on whether relator's absence from work due to being in jail was or was not avoidable. That's a pretty direct language. This court remanded, not for a de novo hearing, but for findings of fact surrounding the employer's vacation policy, and specifically instructed that if, one, vacation time was, Ms. Sharonzi had vacation time available, and two, there was no rule that prohibited her from using it for the time spent in jail, then her absence following the approval of her employer, and I'll get to that language in a moment, was not employment misconduct. The ULJ on remand.
I would appreciate you getting to that particular language following approval of the employee sooner rather than later, but go ahead.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Just quickly, the ULJ did not make findings on those issues. The ULJ inserted one additional finding of fact and then repeated the exact same analysis, as cut and pasted word for word from the decision this court had reversed. So the respondent's argument essentially is that regarding the following the approval of the employer language is that if that changes, then the entire remand order goes away, including paragraph 6 where this court said to the ULJ that you focused on the wrong issue. And we believe that's incorrect for three reasons. First, it's simply not a valid reading of the remand order itself. Second, there wasn't any material change in the record that required a change in the findings between the first and the second hearings. And third, even if this court accepts the amended facts found in the second hearing, that's not legally relevant where the employer gave no communication that would reasonably suggest that the vacation request was being denied. So in terms of the remand order itself, paragraph 6 went on to say, we are aware of no authority to the effect that an employee cannot use vacation time or personal days if available under the employment agreement for days absent while in jail. So the order speaks for itself here. The court, this court is telling the ULJ that the issue is not why Ms. Sharonzi missed work, but whether she had vacation time available under the policy to cover her absence. And that then is the law of the case. This court was presented with the issue of does the reason for the absence establish misconduct? This court decided it did not and remanded for findings on the other issues.
Now, you know, here's what it seems to me is that your argument hinges on persuading us that if an employee asks for vacation and gives 24 hours notice, never mind what the purpose of the vacation is, going to Hawaii or spending the day in jail, forget the purpose. But it seems to me that your argument hinges upon persuading us that if an employee gives 24 hours notice as required by the policy, asks for vacation, the employer must give it. And that is a difficult argument to make to me.
No, Your Honor, I do not believe that that is what you would need to find in order to
reverse here. the evidence is that the employer denied the vacation request.
Your Honor, what the evidence here is that whether the employer intended to approve the vacation request or deny the vacation request, all they communicated to the employee was, got it, thanks.
It wasn't actually communicated to the employee. It was communicated. employee's sister.
That's correct. Who had communicated the vacation request because Ms. Sharanzi wasn't in position to communicate it herself.
And in fact, the employer gave some points to the employee, assigned no fault absentee points mm-hmm. with respect to the first day she was in jail, but it was the second day when she didn't get out of jail until the afternoon, and she wanted vacation to cover that because she knew she would be out of point, exceed the 30 points. Right?
Not exactly, Your Honor. No points were assigned for the first day because she had an exempt personal day that could be used to cover that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So why did she end up exceeding 30 points?
Ms. Sharanzi made the request within 24 hours, or went out of her way to make sure the request reached the employer within 24 hours. At that point, it was completely up to the employer whether to grant the request or not. And there was nothing in the... at the first hearing, we didn't have the benefit of the policy.
I understand.
And now we do. And so what we know now is that there was no set procedure for requesting vacation. There's no language in the policy that would make clear to an average worker that she couldn't make the request through a third party.
Okay.
The policy says that supervisor approval is required, but it also directs supervisors to use available vacation time if the employee is unexpectedly out. The policy does not spell out that it's the supervisor approval rather than the 24-hour notice that triggers points versus no points. The policy, we're dealing with two different policies that are 30 pages apart in the employee handbook here, and there's nothing that spells out that.
In addition to the policy, I'm assuming that has fairly broad language. Is there anything then specifically in the record as to what her supervisor, other than that email, or whatever, I think it was an email, I got it. Was there a no, a yes to that vacation request?
So, Your Honor, in the first hearing, the Human Resources Director testified from the get-go, transcript 1, page 28, that there was an email from Ms. Sharanzi's sister saying that she was in jail. The only testimony about the response in that hearing was from Ms. Sharanzi. She had received hearsay from her sister that the supervisor had asked if she was okay and mentioned something about hitting a deer, which is apparently what happened to another employee that day. The supervisor participated in the first hearing and didn't controvert that testimony. The second hearing a year later, the actual email to the supervisor was produced. The responsive email from the supervisor was never produced, despite there being a subpoena for it. The supervisor by that time didn't have any specific memory of what he'd done or why. If you look at the second transcript, page 38, he says, well, evidently I denied it, and it was either because of this or that. So by that point, both of the sender of the email and the receiver of the email testified from memory a year later that the only response was something along the lines of, got it, thanks. So that's all there was.
Doesn't it really boil down to, other than your arguments about how you think we must interpret the remand order, setting that aside, isn't the question here really whether or not the employer had the discretion under its policies to deny the vacation request?
And Your Honor, I think what's going to be useful here in there's a couple of responses to that. I mean, first of all, this was not silence on the part of the employer. There's nothing in "got it, thanks" that would put Ms. Sharanzi or her sister on notice that the request wasn't being approved.
Well,
we don't know what would have happened.
What could she have done anyway?
We don't know if she could have somehow arranged for somebody to cover that shift. I think what is true under the statute is that there's no reasonable expectation that an employee can read an employer's mind. But in terms of the law, Your Honor, I think the case that's most instructive is the Supreme Court's Jenkins case. So this was one where this is an interpretation of the current statutes.
But that had to do with work release.
It had to do with work release, but the interpretation of the statutes, I believe, carries over. It involved a situation where the applicant was physically prevented from showing up to work because she was incarcerated. and where the employer's only stated reason for the termination was the absence itself, not the underlying arrest. And the way that, and that was a situation where the employer could have but did not approve the work release. The way that the Supreme Court analyzed the statutes in that case was it looked at the two prongs of misconduct. The first question was, did the employer have a reasonable expectation that the employee would be at work that day, i.e., was there notice? The dissent in Jenkins argued that the employer has the right to expect the employee to show up every day when they're scheduled. That view was rejected 6-1. It recognizes that, you know, sometimes there are circumstances where an employee just can't make it in, like where they're physically detained. Jenkins also made clear that under that prong of misconduct, the employer's response to the notice isn't what controls the determination of misconduct. And that's consistent with the court's later kind of statement of principle in the Stagg case, which is that you focus on the employee's conduct, not the employer's. In terms of the second prong of misconduct, substantial disregard for the employment, the court said that the conduct leading to an arrest can be a consideration, but it placed its primary emphasis on whether the employee, and this is a quote, made the arrangements within his or her power to facilitate his or her employment. So what happened here is that Ms. Sharanzi went out of her way to get notice to the employer 24 hours in advance, which is what she reasonably understood that she would have to do to avoid points under the policy. On a much shorter timeline than the applicant in Jenkins had, she recognized the likelihood that she wasn't going to be able to call. She arranged to have an email sent. She emphasized that it needed to be sent more than 24 hours ahead so that it would be a timely vacation request under the employer's policy. The employer had actual notice that she wasn't going to be in. And the employer's human resources rep conceded at the second hearing that there was really nothing else that she could have done.
Well, okay. I don't know why you're going to Jenkins necessarily. It's a jail case. And I will agree with you. I think that the ULJ focused far too much on the reason for the absence here, contrary to the remand order specifically. And I'm having a difficult time even understanding why the fact that Ms. Sharanzi was in jail is relevant at all in this case. The issue seems to me to be a question of whether or not the employer had the discretion to approve or deny the vacation request. Had the employer approved the vacation request, there would have been no points assigned and there would have been no exceeding of the 30-point maximum.
Well, Your Honor, I think this goes back to the basic kind of truism in this area of law, that the question is not whether Ms. Sharanzi should have been fired, but whether the circumstances of the termination, specifically her actions, rise to the level of employment misconduct. Exactly.
I know, and I haven't read any argument in your brief or heard any argument, and I don't know what the legal basis would be for an argument to suggest that an employer like Varacon can't have a point system, characterizes as no fault, and says, look, here's our policy, here's how you accumulate points, and if you exceed 30 points, it's cause for termination, i.e., misconduct.
And Your Honor, cause for termination and misconduct are not the same thing. The question is, that Varacon can have whatever policy it wants. It can, this is an employment at will state. It can fire her for any reason. It can fire her for no reason, as long as it's not specifically prohibited like discrimination.
But the points are assigned for absenteeism.
That's correct, Your Honor, but simply exceeding the point total is not, off the top of my head, the case that's jumping to mind is the GERR, G-E-R-R versus Target Fridley, and I don't have the site in front of me because I wasn't expecting to have to cite it. But that was a situation in which I believe that was another no-fault policy, where the issue was simply where this court said if the employee properly reported the reasons for her absences, properly followed the policy, then it's not misconduct. It's not that the employee violated any expectation the employer has the right to expect. It's not that the employee showed a disregard for the employment. simply missing work too much is not misconduct in and of itself. The question, if the employee followed the vacation policy to the best of her ability. And that's what happened here.
So your argument is that any employee at Vericon who exceeds 30 points and is therefore terminated because of excess absenteeism is, it's going to be a fact question in each case whether or not that absenteeism constitutes misconduct or does not.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And it's going to depend on what, it's going to depend on whether the policy was followed, whether the proper procedures to report in were followed.
Well, I'm assuming they were followed.
Yeah, I believe that's established in this case, Your Honor. So that's absolutely correct.
Okay.
And I guess I'm out of time.
All right, I'll give you a chance for rebuttal.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Froelich, and I represent the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. We ask this court to affirm the decision of the unemployment law judge as it is legally and factually correct.
Will you please spell your last name for
yes.
me?
Yes, F-R-O-E-L-I-C-H.
Thank you.
It is on the brief, although not on the calendar.
I'm sorry. I won't take up, we'll give you a few extra seconds. I don't see it on the...
It's not on your cop?
Brief.
Okay, I apologize for
maybe
that.
I thought it was. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's on the red brief.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay.
So sorry. Is that a Meadowlands name?
Sorry?
Froelich?
It's a married name, so I don't have a lot of information
right,
on
okay.
the history.
All right, thank you. It is on the brief. Mistake. Go ahead.
An employer has the right to reasonably expect that employees will work their scheduled shifts. And employees who are discharged for failing to work those scheduled shifts are discharged because of employment misconduct if they failed to work the shift intentionally, negligently, or indifferently. Now, I agree with counsel that the fact that somebody reaches the 30 points in this case doesn't necessarily mean that they were discharged because of employment misconduct. We do have to look at the reasons that they were absent, and it's that reason that it's relevant whether that she was in jail and whether
she committed. In other words, you can give her a break if you wanted.
Sorry?
You could give the employee a break if you wanted to do that.
You could give the employee a break if you wanted to do that as the employer. You could also, if a case came before an unemployment law judge and that person wasn't eligible for protection under the FMLA, but they had a serious medical condition and they were absent because of their own medical condition and properly notified the employer and still reached the 30 points and were discharged, that person would clearly come within an exception to employment misconduct. And it's hard to say that that would even meet the definition of intentional, negligent, or indifferent conduct that seriously violates the employer's reasonable expectations. But in this case, that's not what we have. In this case, we have...
I don't know. You seem to be suggesting that employers can't have no-fault point systems.
They can have them, but that doesn't necessarily mean that a discharge under a no-fault absenteeism system will amount to employment misconduct.
Okay.
As counsel said, I agree with that it's an at-will state. They can terminate their employment for any reason except for a illegal reason. And so it comes down to whether they should have been fired does not equal whether or not it's employment misconduct.
Okay, go ahead.
So if I understand, and I'm looking at the remand order as well, part of the issue that they've struggled with is before you get to the misconduct evidence, there has to be first undisputed 30 points. So now we know there's a discharge.
Right.
And one of the issues the court remanded is whether anything in Viacom's policy prohibited Realtor from using the time to cover her time in jail. And it sounds like the record changed a little bit from yes, she's granted to no, she's denied to kind of silence on it in the second hearing. And I would assume the ULJ would have wanted to really hone in on that issue. Number one, was she denied
the vacation time?
And was there any evidence about what the normal process is to grant or deny, how that's relayed, is it in written form, an email, orally by a supervisor, so that we then at least get past the threshold question of there's no dispute that you got over the 30 points.
So there is no dispute that she was given 30 points, and that's what prompted the discharge.
Right, but wasn't it because of that last day that she requested? Because, so I assume
yes.
To get there, there had to be a denial.
Yes.
And how was that denial relayed to her?
As I don't know that the denial was relayed to her until after her termination. However, she admits in her own testimony that the vacation request needed to be approved. She knew that kind of a non-answer, so to speak, was not an approval. And the vacation request needed to be approved before you would not get points for vacation.
So are we presuming that missing email that was subpoenaed by the supervisor, or at least we're presuming that that was the email that said, I deny?
No. Mr. Britt specifically testified that he did not say approved or denied in the email to her sister because it was not her sister's business whether or not that email, whether or not it was approved or denied. That information.
Follow up with then who he did say it to, that it was denied or approved, so that someone then did the calculation of points?
It's not clear what his process was after that. However, he says he did not approve it because if he had approved it, she wouldn't have gotten points and she wouldn't have been discharged at that time. So it's clear from what happened after the fact that he did not approve it. And he testifies that he did not approve it and that, in fact, he did not even consider it a vacation request coming from the sister. And the sister admits, and Mr. Britt also says, that this wasn't a request for vacation. This was merely a heads up, she's not going to be in, she's in jail. So they didn't even construe it as a vacation request to approve it or deny it. It was merely construed as a notification that she wouldn't be in. And his testimony is clear and consistent that he never approved it and he never gave any indication to anyone that it would have been approved. And the fact that she didn't understand that it wasn't approved, she didn't know one way or the other, Ms. Carranzi, that wouldn't have altered her conduct. It's not like she could tell someone, well, look, my absence tomorrow isn't going to be approved, so I need to get out of jail earlier. That just didn't happen. So there's no evidence that she would have acted differently regardless of how it turned out.
If you concede that exceeding 30 points under the absenteeism policy mm-hmm. is not necessarily misconduct, and nobody is disputing here that the employer assigned more than 30 points to this employee, mm-hmm. and the employer is maintaining steadfastly that the only reason the employee was terminated was because she exceeded 30 points, how do we get to misconduct in this case?
It is her conduct that led to her not being able to go to work on January 17th.
She was arrested.
She was arrested because of her criminal conduct.
She was arrested. I don't know what the outcome of her case is.
She pled guilty.
Yeah, well,
after the ULJ made the decision, though, right?
No, it was before the decision. It was after the hearing, but it was before the decision was issued. It was 2 days after the hearing was held.
So the ULJ knew that she had pled guilty from the incident and made findings to
No. The ULJ held the hearing. 2 days after the hearing, Ms. Carranzi pled guilty, but that wasn't in the record. And then after that, the decision was issued.
Okay,
I can't speak definitively whether the ULJ knew about it at the
time.
Well,
in this particular case, the wheels of justice turned quite quickly. But in most cases like this, we might not know for months or more than a year whether an employee who's been arrested and therefore misses some work is ultimately found guilty or not found guilty or pleads guilty. Right. We don't know. And so, is that what the misconduct is going to depend upon in each case?
The ULJ make findings of fact regarding the conduct that led to the arrest. if the ULJ makes a finding of fact that somebody engaged in criminal conduct and was subsequently arrested for that, which they then missed work and didn't have an approved attendance issue, that can amount to employment misconduct. And this court has found that in Winkler versus Park Refuge Service, which, although that was issued before the current definition of employment misconduct, it's consistent with the current definition, and this court has cited to it nearly 20 times in unpublished cases.
Ms. Frelich, I think that's part of what then, honestly, I didn't spend as much time either on the points Mr. Weiss made about the hearsay evidence and related to the arrest. Would that not raise that to a greater issue then if the very criminal incident is the basis one is found to have misconduct? Would not the best way for UALJ is to have a mini trial, would almost have to have a mini trial to have live witnesses to testify as to what actually happened there, since the ULJ is going to rely on that to determine whether misconduct occurred?
I'm not sure I quite understand. You're saying that we need a larger, more broad evidentiary hearing to determine the conduct that happened?
Rather than rely on police reports to make a determination that a crime occurred and it's misconduct.
And this is one of the balancing aspects in an administrative hearing, and I think part of the reason that under the Administrative Procedures Act and under the laws specific to unemployment that the rules of evidence are not applied and there are different standards. Because there isn't always time to do a full, well, I'd say there isn't time to do the full criminal investigation that you need in the criminal context. And so the police report is one thing that the ULJ has. She also has the criminal record. And then before this court, on top of that, is the guilty plea. And now you won't have a guilty plea in all cases because, as Judge Schellhaus mentioned, ultimately the remand kicked this longer, so we have a longer duration than we would have in many cases before this court, which is why we have the guilty plea, because this happened in January of 2017. And so we're 2 years later now. So I think that's why the rules of evidence are relaxed here and why it is appropriate for this court to look at things like the police report. And if you look at the police report, what Ms. Kranzi told the police isn't entirely consistent with the story that she told the ULJ. It's along those same lines, but it's not identical, which is something that the ULJ could have taken into consideration. And then you also have the criminal record and then the guilty plea, as I said. So there is, the evidence on the record does reasonably tend to support in this case that Ms. Kranzi did commit the crime for which she was ultimately jailed and the reason that she ultimately missed work. But going back to Judge Schellhaus's point, the evidence is undisputed that the absence was not approved. The vacation request was not approved. And this case is different, very different from Jenkins, because in Jenkins, the employer was the one who, in fact, prevented her from going to work. Had the employer made one phone call, Jenkins would have been able to do work release and attended work. So in that case, it wasn't a reasonable expectation for the employer to expect the employee to work a shift when it alone was in control of whether or not she could work that shift. That's not the case here. Ms. Kranzi is not going to work because she engaged in criminal conduct for which she was arrested, and now she's in jail. It's her conduct that's prohibiting her from going to work, not the employer's.
Ms. Frelich, again, thinking of this process, then the ULJ, is the ULJ is looking at evidence, including police reports and the conduct that the employer didn't have. All we know is the employer discharge her for 30 points.
Right.
So is that the ULJ has that authority to say, even though the employer didn't consciously know misconduct occurred, therefore your discharge, the employer just said 30 points, you're out, and she was aware of that. The ULJ, though, necessarily is able to look at the facts, up in this case up to a year later, and say, well, if the employer would have known, the employer would have discharged for disconduct because that arrest was criminal behavior.
I would say whether or not the employer, the employer can discharge for any reason or no reason as long as it's not an illegal reason. It doesn't have to categorize the conduct that led to the discharge as misconduct. And in fact, whether or not it does, what the ULJ is looking at is the definition of employment misconduct as it's defined in the statute. So the employer's, I guess, awareness or analysis of whether or not it was misconduct as they define it is a separate determination from that which the ULJ is going to make. And so in these cases where you do have a no-fault attendance policy, the employer is saying, you know, we don't care why you were absent. We don't care if you were sick. We don't care if you're going to Hawaii. We don't care if you're in jail. You're not here. We need someone here. You reached 30 points or whatever it is for a particular employer. That's it. But the ULJ does have the authority to say, well, why were you absent? Does it amount to intentional, negligent, or indifferent disregard of an employer's reasonable expectation? And so, yes, the ULJ does have that authority to go deeper into the reasons for the absences, even when the employer isn't doing that. So here, Ms. Carranzi could not work because she committed a crime. The undisputed evidence in the record shows that the employer did not approve her absence or her vacation request, if it even can be construed as that such, for January 17th. She seriously violated the employer's reasonable expectations, and for that reason, we request that this court find that that this court affirm the decision of the ULJ. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think just to start with a factual correction. Exhibit 27, page 2, is the email that Ms. Charanzi's sister sent to Ms. Charanzi's direct supervisor. It says, if she has vacation, she would like to use that for Tuesday if she gets out. That's a vacation request. Whether the supervisor, in his subjective mind, without communicating it to anybody, didn't think that was a vacation request, certainly doesn't matter to Ms. Charanzi, and I don't think it should matter to this court.
Did that occur after the 30-day process was finished?
No, Your Honor. That email, that was the email that was sent the night that she was arrested. She was arrested the early morning hours of the 16th of January, 2017. She relayed to her daughter to ask her sister to send an email and to make sure that that email showed up before the scheduled start of her shift on the 16th, so that it would be 24 hours in advance of the 17th. Because under the policy, that's the when you're supposed to make your vacation request. And I think what the Jenkins case did not turn on the fact that the did not turn on any sort of an estoppel theory. What Jenkins was decided based on the language of the statutes, but what it has in common with this case is that once Ms. Charanzi had made her request, it was completely within the control of the employer whether to say in its own internal process, we're going to approve this request and not charge her the 4 points, or we're going to deny the request and give her the 4 points. What matters here is the conduct of the employee, whether Ms. Charanzi intentionally missed work or intentionally blew off the policy. She didn't do either of those things. Negligent. I'm sorry.
She intentionally shot somebody.
And Your Honor, that goes back to the law of the case. I mean, that issue has been in front of this court, whether that in and of itself established misconduct. This court determined that it did not. And I think the other piece of the law of the case that's relevant here is then this court then in paragraph 7 of the remand order gave specific instructions for what the court should look at, for what the ULJ needed to look at on remand, and gave a very specific conclusion. If vacation time was available and if there was no rule against using it for time spent in jail, then her absence following the approval of the employer was not misconduct. The question is whether if you take away that following the approval of the employer, even though the no lack of approval was ever communicated in any form that would have put Ms. Charanzi or her sister on notice that it wasn't being communicated, does that vitiate the entire order? Does that put us right back to okay, we can take a second bite at the apple. We can look at the circumstances of the underlying arrest again and all the procedural irregularities that led up to that. It wasn't, you know, Judge Sleater pointed out the issue of uncritically accepting the hearsay in the police report as true, which this court addressed in the Profrock case. How do you believe a declarant who doesn't testify, who might have their own criminal record, who has an obvious motivation to minimize their own culpability in front of the police? There was also the whole process where this ULJ requested and received permission to look up the register of actions of one case, which even that wouldn't be allowed by the Code of Judicial Conduct, went beyond that permission to pull up the entire criminal record, used the criminal record as a basis for a blanket adverse credibility determination. This is why we have cases and cases on Spriegel evidence. Went beyond even that to somehow seek out the police report post-hearing. We don't even know how it got into the record. Didn't provide any opportunity for a testimony in response to the police report. That's what distinguishes this from the Vassier case. And then didn't even hint on remand that it had any intention of resurrecting this issue of the arrest after this court specifically told her to leave it alone. So I think in conclusion, Your Honor, unless you have additional questions, this court ordered a simple, straightforward remand order. On remand, ask two questions. If these two conditions were met, it's not misconduct. Instead of following the order, the ULJ changed a finding of fact and used that as a loophole to issue a decision that was ultimately on the same basis, word for word, cut and pasted, is what this court had reversed. This isn't compliance. The law of the case is that if Ms. Sharanzi had vacation time and no rule prevented her from using it to cover her time in jail, she was not discharged from misconduct. These conditions were met, and we're therefore asking this court to reverse. And unless you have any further questions, Your Honor, I'm out of time.
No further questions. Very interesting case. Well argued. Thank you very much for your arguments. The matter is taken under advisement.